listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it being Friday, it is Brunch with Bernie Day. Senator Bernie Sanders, I think of him as America's senator, but the good people of Vermont know that he is 100% their senator. And my call screening software is booting. It'll take me just a second. And there we go. Senator Sanders. Whoop, here we go. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. I'm sorry for that delay. I run back here and click the button. Yesterday, the farm bill went down in flames. Everybody is, you know, the chattering class are all talking about the Republican Party being in disarray. I suspect not. What are your thoughts on this?
No, I don't think they're in disarray. I think they're doing exactly what they want to be doing. You got a bunch of folks there whose job in life is to protect the wealthy and the powerful, who want to cut back on Social Security or privatize it, cut back, and Medicare as we know it, make devastating cuts in Medicaid, senior programs, education. These guys think that the function of government is to protect the military and to protect the wealthy, and they don't want to do much else. They don't want to protect family farmers. They don't certainly don't want to make sure that kids in this country and seniors get the nutrition that they need. Most of the food stamp program, which they had proposed to cut by over $20 billion, I guess that wasn't enough for some of those guys, food stamp program goes to working families with kids, to the elderly. That's where most of the food stamp money goes. And as poverty remains very, very high in this country, those folks need those programs. So I don't see that the Republicans are dysfunctional. I think they're doing exactly what they want to do, and in many ways they are winning. The middle class is disappearing. Poverty is very high. The wealthy are doing phenomenally well. Corporate profits are off the wall. Tax rates for the rich and corporations are low. So these guys, you know, they know what their mission is, and they are succeeding. So that it doesn't surprise me, but obviously we need a farm bill, and I hope that we can do one. Right now, as you know, to change subjects, we are on an immigration bill in the Senate. And regardless of what happens in the Senate, it remains to be seen whether the House is able to do anything or wants to do anything about a serious issue. My own view is that the immigration bill has a number of very important provisions in it. I think we do need a path toward citizenship for 11 million people in this country who are here illegally. I think we do need to support the DREAM Act, the kids of people who came over the border. I think we certainly need to deal with farm labor in this country and give them legal status. It's a very serious problem. But I'll tell you, Tom, I have some very, very serious concerns about one aspect of the bill, which has not gotten a whole lot of attention. That is these guest worker programs. And the bottom line here is you have the high-tech companies spending a whole lot of money, and what they're saying is we need to import into this country hundreds of thousands of high-tech workers into our companies. And their argument is there simply are not enough American workers who are capable of doing those jobs. And bottom line is, I don't believe that. I think there are some instances where you have specialized work that people in a given geographical area may not be able to do, and companies should have the right to bring people from abroad in. But I think they over-exaggerate the problem. There's a problem. I think they over-exaggerate it. And I think they want to flood the market with foreign high-tech workers who work for lower wages than American workers. And I, given the fact that unemployment in this country continues to be very, very high, while it is going down, we've made progress in the last 5 years, real unemployment, counting those people who have given up looking for work and those people who are working part-time, is almost 14%. If you are an African-American, if you're a young person, the numbers are substantially higher. So before we open the doors to foreign workers in guest worker programs, I think we want to make sure that American workers get the jobs that they need. Now, that's high-tech stuff. Then you got low-tech, then you got entry-level work. People don't know that in this bill, you're looking at hundreds, again, opening the door to hundreds of thousands of workers who are going to work at McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts and Burger King. They're going to work in resorts. They're going to work as lifeguards. They're going to work as waiters and waitresses and dishwashers. And I just, at a time when youth unemployment is very, very high, when a lot of kids trying to save a few bucks to go to college. It bothers me immensely that the jobs that are out there, entry-level jobs that these kids could take, that I did when I was going to college to make a few bucks, may not be there for them. What I'm even more troubled by is you got just a whole lot of kids in this country who are never going to go to college, and that's fine. They graduated high school, and you know what? It is very, very hard for them to get a job. I was in Detroit a couple of weeks ago, and the kids there are able to get jobs in fast food restaurants, McDonald's, etc. They can't even get 40 hours a week. They're getting 30 hours a week, 20 hours a week at $7.25 an hour. And do we want those kids to be competing against people from around the world in various programs called the J-1 program, guest worker program? Those are college students from abroad coming in, 100,000 of those guys. Or the H-2B program, more low-wage workers coming into this country? I think not. Now, what I'm working on is, at the very least, I'm trying to change those programs. And needless to say, corporate America is not very happy about that. But at the very, very, very least, what I want is a jobs program for our young people. And we've introduced an amendment for $1.5 billion for a two-year program that would provide about 400,000 summer and year-round employment opportunities for young people. I hope very much that at the very least that gets passed, because it's a serious problem and we've got to address it. So that's an issue that's on the floor. I'm chairman of the subcommittee that looks at senior issues. We are working on the Older Americans Act. The Older Americans Act is not as well known, obviously, as Medicare and Medicaid, but it's a very important provision signed by Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s. And what it does is it's the program that funds Meals on Wheels, which is the nutrition program that provides meals to very frail seniors who can't leave their homes, funds what's called the Congregate Meal Program, which is funding for senior center meal programs, funds employment programs for seniors. Very, very important issue. It's been underfunded for years. And what we find with seniors, if they are isolated, if they're alone, if they're not getting good nutrition, and a whole lot of seniors are struggling with very, very serious economic problems, what happens is, you know, they get, if you're not eating well, you're going to end up getting sicker more often. You're going to end up in the emergency room. You're going to end up in the hospital. And it costs a lot more money to keep people in the hospital for preventable illnesses, keep them, take care of them in the emergency room than it does to provide decent nutrition. So we are asking for a significant increase in this program. We got, I think, 18 co-sponsors on board this, and we're going to try to get some Republican support for it. But I think it's a very good investment. It's the morally right thing to do. You can't turn your back on the people who have worked hard to make this country great, who have fought in our wars, who have raised us, and who need help right now. Other issue that we're working on is I'm on both the Energy and Environmental Committees, and I'm working with the chairman of those committees. Barbara Boxer is chair of the Environmental Committee, and Barbara and I are working on very strong global warming legislation, which would impose a carbon fee on major carbon polluters in America, raise a whole lot of money, and disincentivize the use of carbon. Right now, the scientists around the world and others are telling us that we are looking at a very dangerous situation, that we need to transform our energy system away from carbon into energy efficiency and sustainable energy, and we're going to try to make that happen.
Spectacular. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders taking your calls. We'll be back with Senator Bernie Sanders right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Check out Bernie's website, by the way, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for his newsletter, The Bernie Buzz, and there's always a great stack of information there. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders. Ike in North Charleston, South Carolina. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, man, I've been waiting a long time to talk to you, Mr. Sanders. Forgive me, I'm out trying to make a living painting a house, so and I might get a little emotional. Look, here's the deal. I've been working construction for 32 years or better. Ex-union member. I live in the South, so I don't really have much chance of being in a union anymore. This is my problem, and I've watched it get worse and worse over the years. Every contractor I come up on, including the one I'm working for now, they don't want to pay me other than pay me as a subcontractor. And I've read the IRS code. I know what it takes to be a subcontractor. I've been a contractor. Basically, they're breaking the law. They're paying me cash under the table, and they're not paying my taxes. And I'm in tax trouble because of it, and it's putting my whatever little money I'm going to have, if I should live that long, to be able to get Social Security. I need help. We need to stop this. You know, I mean, I work hard, but I don't make enough to put 15% away of my money and pay my taxes on a quarterly basis. And I know it's going to get me in the end, and I know I'm in trouble now, but is there some way we can stop these employers from abusing people and classifying us as subcontractors?
Well,
nothing more than hourly employees.
Thank you very much for asking that question. And I want you to know that the question that you have just asked reflects the situation that many, many, many thousands of workers are being forced to live under right now. And what Ike is saying, in case people don't know it, is that instead of being hired as a worker, where his employer is paying his Social Security tax, his percentage of Medicare tax, unemployment tax, all that stuff, what the employer is saying, you're not an employee of mine, you are a subcontract, you're an independent entity. And therefore, Ike has got to pick up the whole cost, which is very, very expensive. In essence, he's self-employed rather than being an employee. Clearly, we know in the construction industry, we hear this every day, that employers are breaking the law, exploiting workers like Ike. And it is, Ike, all I can tell you, it is a serious issue that we are more than aware of. And there are thousands and thousands of workers being unfairly treated as you are. And it is an issue that we're trying to address. As with many, many other issues, it is hard to protect working people when you have a political party in control of the House, which could care less about these issues, could care less about working families. But it is an issue, Ike, we are aware of. You are right, and we're going to do everything we can to address it.
Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Charles, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, how you doing, Senator Sanders? It is my pleasure and my honor to speak to you today. I love the work that you're doing in the Senate, and I only can implore that you do more. And, you know, as long as the good Lord gives you health and strength. But I have a question for you. I've noticed that included in the new immigration bill that the Republicans are proposing, that they put a surplus amount of, I guess, border agents or insurgents or troops on the border. And my question is, you know, As you can clearly see, that I live in Miami, Florida. I'm part of the South. There is no industry here that provides, you know, jobs as consistent as everywhere else. And basically, these southern governors are dependent on federal aid for whatever, you know, it is to prop up their budgets. And I'm only thinking that this is just another ploy for the Republicans to get their hands on federal dollars that can be used for something else. In the guise that, you know, they're trying to stop aliens from crossing the border, or that they're also, stopping the illegals from coming and getting jobs. Of course, they were the ones, I think, that allowed illegals to take the jobs of many Americans, and it's only just another way that they use slave labor, you know, to gain a profit. and the American public had to suffer for this. And that's why I think that we're in this economic problems that we're facing today.
Well, Charles, thank you very much. And you made two important points, and I agree with both of them. I think everybody wants to make sure the border is secure. And the good news is, in recent years, actually, we have been doing a lot better job. It's tough to do. But we have made, I think everybody recognizes, great progress along the border. I think if you talk to the governors of Arizona and Texas, they will tell you that illegal immigration has been significantly reduced. What the Republicans want to do now is to put billions and billions and billions of dollars, as Charles has indicated, into border security. We're already spending a whole lot of money. They want to spend many, many, many times more. They want a whole array of troops. Not quite clear to me how many thousands we are talking about. And I think Charles's first point is that this will be an economic boom. There's a lot of federal money coming in. Will benefit those states along the border. And I think he is absolutely right. We should not be naive about it. So that's point number one. And the second point, that these guys were worried about illegal immigrants. At the same time, in the same bill, you have Republicans out there, and you have some Democrats too, I should tell you, who want to bring in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of low-wage workers into this country, so that folks in Florida and in Vermont and elsewhere are going to have to compete against additional low-wage labor. And those are the issues that we are dealing with. It's not a great bill, and I'm trying to, you know, figure out what I'm going to do with it. As I mentioned earlier, I've got a youth employment program in there, which will make it a lot better bill.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back with more Bernie. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in the place where despair is not an option. And this is the Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls on the issues of the day. Senator, you're with us?
I am right here.
Okay. Harry in Seattle, Washington, watching Free Speech TV. Harry, you're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. Senator, you know, I've never heard a Republican point out the fact that if everybody who hires folks, if you went to jail for hiring somebody who's not legally entitled to work in this country, people would quit coming across the border. And is E-Verify, the only people I hear pointing that out are Democrats. And E-Verify seems to, it seems to me that if we would just all adhere to this, we could bring the problem to a screeching halt.
Harry, I think you make a very, very important point that is not discussed enough. We hear people saying what a terrible thing it is that for the last 20 years we've had millions of people attempt to come across the border, many of them successfully come across the border. Isn't this a horrible, terrible, terrible thing? They're breaking the law. What we don't hear very much discussion about is the degree to which for many years, including under the Bush administration and before that, it was very, very clear that government quite intentionally looked the other way when all of this illegal behavior was happening and basically gave a wink and a nod to employers to say, sure, you want to run a packing house or meat slaughtering place? Or a farm and you want to hire all illegal immigrants, don't worry about it. Not a problem. You get them for slave labor, not a problem. We're not going to prosecute you. So the blame has always been on the people who cross the border in search of a better life, in search of making a few bucks. And Harry's point is very well taken. These people would not be coming across the border, could not survive across the border if they could not get jobs. And 9 times out of 10, the employer knew that they were illegal, and in fact, the employer was able to take advantage of the fact that they had no rights. They could not speak up for themselves. So, you know, for many years, many of our law and order guys, the people who just want to throw the book at everybody, kind of turned the other way because they had an opportunity to get a lot of cheap labor. And certainly, if the law was enforced on employment, we would not have this problem.
Dan in Paris, France, listening on WCPT's web stream. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. You're both two American heroes and want to thank you for everything you're doing. Just had a question and just trying to see if there might be some type of relationship between what's being proposed right now with the increased border security and the thousands of additional guards and the drawdown of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. I've often wondered what will happen as we draw down those wars with all the private contractors, as corporations are always looking for new markets. And the question is, could we find ourselves with private contractors filling those roles and then effectively end up with mercenaries on U.S. territory?
Well, that's a very reasonable question, Dan, and I don't know the answer to it. I'm not quite sure that anybody does. The question and the point that Dan is making, which is a very, very important question, and it has gotten a lot of attention recently with regard to Edward Snowden, who is a private contractor working for a company called Booz Allen on contract with the NSA. It just makes the point that we have an enormous number of government services now being done not by employees of the United States government, but by private contractors. And the issue is that in fact a cost-effective way to do those services, or in fact is this a boondoggle by which private companies are making a whole lot of money? And I think by and large the latter is probably right, in Iraq and Afghanistan and throughout the military, you're seeing just a whole lot of money going into private contractors, which are doing services that can be done by the government with more accountability and, in fact, at lower cost. So I think Dan's point is well taken.
Walter in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah. Hi.
Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio, by the way.
Yes, sir. I'm here. Can you hear me, Tom?
Yep. Just fine.
Yeah, I'll be right back. Tom, can you hear me okay?
I hear you fine. You're on the air with Bernie. Hey.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. Senator Sanders, thanks so much for taking time with me here. Sir, I am so absolutely frustrated and about to pull my hair out that I get so tired of all of the sideshows with all of the scandals that are going on, you know, in the Obama administration, mostly brought on by the right wing and by conservatives. But the point that's so frustrating is that neither the House nor the Senate are focusing on jobs. It's really so simple. Bring the jobs back, the tax base goes up, the debt goes down. The debt goes down, and America comes back to prosperity. Not the House, not the Senate, not anyone is focused on that. We got all of the sideshows. It is so absolutely frustrating.
Well,
how do you address...
Okay, thank you very much for that important question. I agree with you. We're getting a lot of great questions today, Tom.
And I agree. Walter's is a great one.
And people, you know, question after question, hitting the nail right on the head. The most important domestic issue that we face is to create millions of decent-paying jobs. Right now, as I mentioned earlier, real unemployment is not 7.5%. Real unemployment is close to 14% if you include those people who work in part-time, and those people who have given up looking for work. Unemployment is higher for young people. Unemployment is higher for people of color, and in some parts of the country, unemployment is just off the wall. Walter is right. What the Republicans and the big money interests have had Congress focus on is deficit reduction. Now, deficit reduction is, in my view, an important issue. No question about it. But the deficit was caused primarily by two unpaid wars, tax breaks for the rich, and the Wall Street caused recession, which resulted in less revenue coming into the federal government. Be that as it may, we have now cut the deficit in half. It is time to focus on creating millions of jobs. And some of the ways you do that, as I've said many, many times, is that you rebuild your infrastructure, roads, bridges, rail, water systems, schools. Put a whole lot of people at work doing that. You tackle climate change, global warming, by moving away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency. Making our homes and offices and buildings more energy efficient creates huge amounts of jobs. especially if the products are manufactured in the United States, move to wind, solar, geothermal. We're making progress in all of those areas. We can do a lot more, fund small businesses, give small businesses the help they need at affordable interest rates, tell Wall Street that they have got to invest in America, in the productive economy, and stop their bloody gambling casino, which only makes Wall Street richer. So you do some deal with the trade policy, which encourages corporations to send jobs to China, deal with the immigration issue, which stops low-wage workers from coming into the United States. So we can create the jobs that we need. And as Walter pointed out, you create jobs, you create taxpayers, they pay taxes, the deficit goes down. So Walter is right. Now is the time to focus on jobs. Now, I will tell Walter that in the immigration bill that we are currently working on, I have an amendment in there that I hope will be adopted. I think we stand a reasonable chance to see it adopted, which will put $1.5 billion into creating some 400,000 jobs for our young people in the next couple of years. Is that enough? No. Is that a step forward? It is. We need to put all of our people who are unemployed back to work. We also need to focus on the young people who need a foot in the door to start their careers.
Bill in Great Cacapon, Wisconsin, or West Virginia, rather?
You're close. It's Cacapon.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, you're on the air with Bernie.
Okay, thank you. We're just outside of Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. Thank you for taking my call. Senator?
Yep, yep.
My priority, I feel, this deal with Monsanto.
Monsanto?
Monsanto Protection Act. Has Congress done anything about that? And I understand, I don't know whether it's been proven or not, that this generic, which has been thrown out of Europe, generic seeds, is killing the beehives here in the States.
No, genetically modified. Okay, Bill, let's get Bernie's answer. We just have a minute to the break.
Actually, Bill, what Bill is talking about is Monsanto, a very powerful biotech company. That has developed a whole lot of genetically modified crops. I introduced an amendment a couple of months ago, Bill, that would give states the authority to demand labeling, to put labeling on products that contain genetically modified food. I lost that amendment on the floor of the Senate, very strongly opposed by Monsanto and many of the other high-tech companies. The truth of the matter is that we just don't know enough about the long-term consequences of genetically modified food. What we do know is that throughout Europe and in dozens of other countries, products that have genetically modified organisms are labeled, and I want to see that in the United States. The American people have at least the right to know what is in their food.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls, more of your calls for Bernie, in just a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And perhaps more importantly, check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for his newsletter there. It's free and just a ton of great information. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's the Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Denise in, is it Wadena, Minnesota?
Yes.
You are on the air with Bernie.
Senator Sanders, thank you. Two quick questions. Where are we at with raising the minimum wage, and what do you think the minimum wage should be?
Where we are is the president has called for an increase in the minimum wage to $9 an hour. Tom Harkin and I would like to go above $10 an hour. And I think that's fairly conservative if you look at the fact that the minimum wage has lost purchasing power over the last 20 years or more. So there is going to be, I believe, next week or within the next couple of weeks, a hearing on the minimum wage, which is the way we move the process forward. I would hope that we would have legislation on the floor in the not-too-distant future. So what we're seeing right now are millions of workers working just horrendously low wages. I would go higher than $10 an hour, but that's the best that I think we are hearing right now, and I'll be supporting that legislation.
Ed, listening on Sirius XM in Altamont, Kansas. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Thank you. Senator Sanders, it's good to talk to you, sir.
Thank you, Ed.
My question is this. I've been injured in two accidents that were not my fault over my lifetime, and they have cost me and my wife our retirement. I'm sitting at the pharmacy right now, as a matter of fact, trying to decide which medications we're going to be able to buy and which ones we are not. These two insurance companies drug things out on paying quickly to the point that we were broke and had to take whatever they offered to be able to make ends meet. Is there anything that we can do to keep them from being able to prolong it 2 years and bring it down to like 60 days after all medical issues were taken care of?
Well, Ed, thank you. That's a very, very good question. And I think the issue that you are raising is justice delayed is justice denied. What goes on in the country today in cases, insurance claims cases that you're talking about, but other cases as well, is the people who have deep pockets can hire lawyers, can make appeals, can drag things out and force people who don't have a whole lot of money to make a settlement which is less than perhaps they should have gotten. So the answer is yes. I mean, obviously we can try to move forward, and it's a very serious problem. I mean, on big cases, that goes beyond an individual's claim. These corporations can drag things on year after year after year. So, Ed, you raise a very good point, and I think it as a result of federal and state legislation, we should make sure that that time period is less.
Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders and Tom. Good
Hi.
Day to you both.
Thank you.
Just like to say, I'm from Oklahoma, and we are noted as a gas and oil state. We've got the biggest Indian tribe in the country. Eastern half of the state is wooded, hilly. Western half of the state is flat. This is great territory for growing hemp. And I'm wondering, all across the nation now, why are we not hearing any discussion of hemp as a natural resource base for restoring our economy and restoring the environment? I mean, there's just no discussion of it at all on the air that amounts to more than a minute or two before people start rolling their eyes and shrugging their shoulders and giggling at each other. Can we say hemp as in help end marijuana prohibition so that farmers all across this country can grow a very easy-to-grow crop that can be used to make all kinds of products and restore our manufacturing economy almost within two seasons?
Well, let me just say this, Bob. It's not quite accurate to say there is no discussion about it. I mean, right now, I mean, you're talking about two separate issues. You're talking about hemp. And you're talking about, I think, decriminalizing the use of marijuana. And I could tell you that there is discussion about hemp, and I support that discussion, and I support going forward. Excuse me. In terms of decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana, states are beginning to do that. And I think that's a good thing. There have been a number of referenda in states around the country. What is it, Tom, in Colorado where they're now?
Yeah, Colorado and Washington State, both decriminalized recreational pot.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, not to mention the use of medical marijuana.
Right, which is in 20-some-odd states.
So, you know, I think there has been a lot of movement in recent years. Should we go further? I think we should. But it's not accurate to say there has been no discussion. The only area that I would disagree is I think some of the people who are proponents of hemp think it's
you know, as I think Bob does, it's going to be the cure-all in life. It's going to rebuild the economy and create all these things. I don't happen to think so. I mean, I think it's another product out there. I think it's useful to see what we can do with it. But I don't see it as any kind of panacea. But, you know, should we go forward on it? Absolutely.
1 minute to wrap up the hour. Senator, thoughts on the weekend?
Well, my thoughts are that I hope that people are paying attention to what's going on in Washington. A lot of very, very important issues. Immigration is a huge issue. It's something that we should have dealt with more effectively years ago. I am in support, as I said earlier, about many of the provisions in the bill. I am very concerned about the guest worker program pushed by corporate America that, in my view, I want to bring a lot of cheap labor into this country. I think also that we have got to continue to focus on jobs. We heard that point being made by several of our callers today. We need absolutely to create millions of jobs in this country, and we can do it if we have the political will to make it happen.
Thank you, Bernie. Thanks so much for being with us again this week.
Okay, my pleasure, Tom.
Great talk. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. What's on your mind? I got a couple of things. Oh, I want to tell you about a new quote from the Pope to begin right after the break.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boing, off he goes. Thank you, Danielle. There's an amazing piece. It's Anything Goes Friday. I'm going to be picking up your calls in just a second. But I have to share this one thing with you. But actually, I have to share two things with you before we go any further. Give me a couple of minutes, then we'll pick up your calls. The farm bill failed yesterday in the House of Representatives. It was bizarre to watch Eric Cantor blame Nancy Pelosi for the farm bill failing when you can't filibuster in the House of Representatives. You can filibuster in the Senate, but you can't in the House. I mean, the Speaker can refuse to bring something to the floor. So it's kind of like, you know, one-man rule, or woman in the case of Nancy Pelosi. But there's really no filibuster. So it's a majority vote. And the Republicans have a majority of the votes in the House of Representatives. So they can pass anything they damn well please if they all agree on it. And apparently they didn't all agree on this farm bill, which just had these draconian cuts in food stamps. But that's not why they didn't agree on it. There were all these different reasons. So anyhow, that didn't pass. And, you know, what does that mean for larger and more substantial pieces of legislation like immigration reform? And all of this goes back to that meeting. Bernie made a brief reference to it, I believe, and when he said in passing that, you know, from the very first day that Obama was sworn in, the Republicans have been pursuing a path of obstruction. And Robert Draper, in his book Ask Not What Good We Do, laid it out, and it's now in several other books that reference Robert Draper's book, that there was this group of Republicans who got together early on and said, okay, you know, we're going to do everything we can to make sure that Barack Obama has no successes. None. None whatsoever. And you know, in fact, one of them said, you know, we're going to use the Taliban as our role model. So I was looking for, I've got the article here, but I don't know if I can, it's buried. Anyway, this is something that, you know, people need to be talking more about, that the Republicans are absolutely invested in having a bad economy. One of the callers pointed out, if, for example, unemployment were to drop from 7% down to 4%, you know, where it is when the economy is really rolling along, Social Security would be just fine. You'd have more people paying into Social Security. Because the only people who pay into Social Security are people who make under 100 and what is it, 18,000, 13,000, something like that these days. You know, a little less than $120,000 a year. So, which is, you know, pretty much everybody who's working, but if they're unemployed, they're not paying into Social Security. And in fact, if they're unemployed and disabled, they're taking money out of Social Security. So if we could put people back to work, the budget deficit would go down. People would be paying taxes. Social Security would be fine. There's just all kinds of stuff that would happen. But the Republicans don't want that to happen because then they wouldn't be able to make an argument for privatizing Social Security and giving that $2.7 trillion trust fund to their friends on Wall Street who are salivating over it. So, number one. Number two, the Pope. We got a commie Pope. God bless him. I mean that literally. Pope Francis said Thursday, this Reuters, Dateline Rome, said Thursday that financial speculation and corruption were keeping millions of people in hunger. And that the financial crisis could not be used as an alibi for failing to help the poor. Here is his exact quote. He referred to the dictatorship of the economy, his phrase. He said, it is a well-known fact that the current levels of production are sufficient, yet millions of people are still suffering and dying of starvation. He's talking about production of food. This is truly scandalous. A way has to be found to enable everyone to benefit from the fruits of the earth and not simply to close the gap between the affluent and those who must be satisfied with the crumbs falling from the table. There is a need to oppose the short-sighted economic interests and the mentality of power of a relative few who exclude the majority of the world's peoples. End of quote from Pope Francis. It's enough to make you want to convert to Catholicism. There's another fascinating article in the New York Times. This is by Amartya Sen. Let me see if there's a little bio here at the end, because I've seen his byline. Yeah, he's a Nobel laureate, professor of economics and philosophy at Harvard, and the author of a book called An Uncertain Glory, India and Its Contradictions. And he's talking about the headline, the title of it is Why India Trails China. I recommend this to you. What's unsaid in this article is more important in my mind than what's said for Americans. Now, what it is, it's in an article, you know, comparing India and China, two of the most rapidly developing countries in the world. And India is not developing anywhere near as fast as China. Yet they speak English there. They have, you know, a lot of, and it's a functioning, fully functioning democracy, one of the largest the largest in the world, over 1 billion people. And an actual real democracy compared to China, which is, you know, more of a demand economy and more of a less democratic state, shall we say. And he points out that the main difference between the two, he says, the hope that India might overtake China one day in economic growth now seems a distant one, but that comparison is not what should worry Indians the most. The far greater gap between India and China is in the provision of essential public services. He's talking about things like a national health care program, good roads, good high-speed rail, good transportation, good housing. He said the far greater gap between India and China is the provision of essential public services, a failing that depresses living standards and is a persistent drag on growth. See, here he's making the point that I keep making, that good public facilities, good public education, free college education, high-quality, you know, primary schools and secondary schools, high-quality education, good infrastructure, a good national healthcare system, that these are the soil in which business puts its roots. These are the things that are necessary for a successful economy. China figured this out. So here, as this Nobel Prize-winning economist, he says, India may be the world's largest producer of generic medicine, but its healthcare system is an unregulated mess. While China devotes 2.7% of its gross domestic product to government spending on healthcare, India only allots 1.2%. He said China has done far more than India to raise life expectancy, expand general education, and secure health care for its people. And he just, you know, he goes through this whole thing. He talks about how Japan, when the Meiji Restoration in 1868, they just said, okay, that's it. We're going to educate everybody. And boom! You know, Japan was doing really well. Now, what was unsaid in the article where he's basically comparing India and China, what was unsaid is the United States. Now, I realize, you know, he's a writer about India. He's ethnically Indian. I believe he's an American citizen. But his point is that this is the problem that India has, is that perhaps because it's a democracy. You know, China is not a democracy, and so the leaders of China can simply say, okay, that's it. We're going to decide today that tomorrow morning we're going to build a high-speed train that's 5,000 miles long and do it and have it done in 2 years. Because nobody's going to say, what? That's communism! Or whatever. And then once the high-speed train is in, then all these businesses come saying, hey, you know, I want to build a factory along that train route. Just like businesses all across America wanted to build factories and communities along the interstate highways when Eisenhower built those.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In other words, if we want to reindustrialize and rebuild America, we need to start with our infrastructure. 15 minutes past the hour. Hey, just a quick heads up. Tomorrow at 2:30 here in Washington, D.C., I'll be over at the Portrait Gallery. We're going to be showing, well, actually, not we, Barbara Kopple, the two-time Oscar-winning filmmaker, is going to be showing a film called Running from Crazy, starring Mariel Hemingway, and it's about the Hemingway family, by and large, and just a fascinating story about, from the press release, behind closed doors, however, the family has been plagued by mental illness, substance abuse, and suicide, which seems to carry from one generation to the next. Two-time Oscar-winning filmmaker Barbara Kopple explores this troubling legacy through the eyes of Mariel Hemingway, whose firsthand reflections add fascinating insight. I'll be there, and I'll be doing questions and answers afterward, or moderating questions and answers with Barbara Kopple afterwards. So if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, be sure to drop by. I think you'll find that very, very interesting. So that said, it is Anything Goes Friday, and enough of my ranting. Your turn, Dave in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I don't agree with everything that you say, but I'm quite sure that your opinions are not bought and paid for. That being said, I think the biggest problem in our political system right now is the huge amounts of money that are involved in the election process, whether it be lobbying, campaign funding, or the so-called nonprofits, et cetera. And I think it's been an ongoing process, but the Citizens United decision has definitely exacerbated it. And I've also got a question for you. Do you believe there should be or could there be term limits on the Supreme Court judges? And if so, I know that they're supposed to have, you know, their decisions are supposed to be unbiased on, you know, constitutional law, but they're so obviously political.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if you've got anything to say about that.
Sure, I do. I think that, and this is what FDR tried to do. His court packing scheme is what it was referred to as. What it was, what it explicitly was that there would be a position on the court called Supreme Court Justice Emeritus, as opposed to Associate Justice or Chief Justice. There would be Justice Emeritus, and that would be one vote on the court. And it would be made up of the aggregated votes of all the members of the court who are over 70. And so that was a sort of term limit or a sort of forced retirement. He didn't succeed in pushing that through Congress. He actually stopped trying. It never came to a vote or anything like that. And, you know, it was an attempt to do something under Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. Congress certainly has the authority to do that. They can define the terms on which the court works. I think, though, that that's dancing around the edges of the real problem. The real problem is that the court has exceeded its authority, and it has been exceeding its authority since 1803 in the Marbury versus Madison decision, when they came up with the idea, which then President Jefferson was horrified by, that the court could strike down laws passed by Congress and claim that they were the final arbiters of what the Constitution meant. This is a position known as judicial review. And it has become so established that the court pretty much does nothing but that now, whereas the first 50, 60, 70 years of our republic, the court only did it a couple of times. It was very, very rare. The court is supposed to be, if you read the Constitution, the Supreme Court is designed to be either the court that has federal jurisdiction, in other words, resolves disputes between states or between our country and other countries, or the final court of appeals. So if you sue me, and our lawsuit bounces back and forth going up through the courts, it's got to find a place where it finally stops, and that's the final decision. But the idea of the founders, and certainly of Thomas Jefferson, was that the power to decide what is constitutional and what isn't should be with, to literally quote Thomas Jefferson, with the people themselves. In other words, if Congress passes an unconstitutional law, it's up to us to throw the bums out and vote in people who will pass a constitutional law, rectify that situation, and or a president who signs an unconstitutional law. And so, trying to regulate the powers of the court without or trying to, you know, term limit the court, for example, I don't think is necessarily a good idea. I think it would be a lot of effort for a relatively small return. And it would require, you know, serious legislation. If you're going to do that, I would go after judicial review. Does that make sense, Dave?
Yeah.
Okay.
Listen, I got a book to plug, and it's have you ever read any Jeffrey Sachs?
Oh yeah, the man who mistook his wife for a hat, and the geographer or anthropologist from Mars, and yes, I've read at least three of his books.
It's called The Price of Civilization, The Price of Civilization, mm-hmm. And it's a very comprehensive book that covers a lot of issues, political, economic, very easy to read, and, it's something that I think everybody should read it.
Great. Okay, plug made. Dave, let's get some more folks in here. Thanks a lot for the call. Joan in Owosso, Michigan. Hey, Joan, what's up?
I can't afford it. Spend a day with you, but I'd like to have you spend a day with me and also Bernie Sanders.
Thank you.
I'll tell you, I've got so many subjects.
Pick one. We just have a minute to the break.
1985, Reagan had the dairy herd buyout, and the next year they came out with that bovine growth hormone. It took 20 years to stop that. How long is it going to stop Monsanto seed? And they don't just put seed together. They're putting animal genes with it.
Yep.
And I think that's what's caused the problem. And we used to side dress Roundup, and now they use it right in the seed.
Yep.
That's our problem. We got to get these rules and regulations back. They don't want to obey or save our country.
I don't disagree with you. I have very serious concerns about genetically modified organisms in our food supply, and there's some pretty scary science about it. Monsanto continues to insist that they're safe. Thank you, Joan, for the call. Other countries say no, not so much, and you can't sell GMOs in our country. And then there are other countries that say, well, you can, but you have to at least let people choose whether they want them or not by labeling them. Here in the United States, Monsanto spent millions of dollars just to stop the state of California by ballot initiative from requiring labeling of GMOs. So I think we need to do something about it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, labeling is just a good start. Chipotle is labeling their GMO products on their website. Good start. Welcome back, Tom. I'm here with you. Yes, in the chat room, Miriam Delgado, that's Oliver Sacks, Tom. Jeffrey Sacks is the dubious born-again poverty reliever. Some even thought he was a shock doctrine pusher. He is. You're right. Jeffrey Sacks writes more about economics, and Oliver Sacks, I mixed them up. Thanks for the heads up on that and the correction. We don't only have the smartest listeners on Earth. We've got the smartest chat room on Earth. It's cool. It's free. It's over at TomHartman.com. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, it's Anything Goes Friday, and thanks for watching on the TomHartman.com page.
Well, thank you, Tom. And I'd like to talk about photovoltaics and why it is the least expensive form of electricity generation. You know, they never talk about externalities. And the four horsemen of the apocalypse, coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear, they're second only to agriculture in their use of our freshwater resources.
Mm-hmm.
And solar panels use no water in the production of clean renewable energy over the 20 to 50 year lifetime. So and other externalities exist as well, the destruction of the environment due to CO2 release. But they're never factored in. They still say photovoltaics is too expensive. But if you take the water alone, then photovoltaics is the least expensive, you know, because the cost of not only the water but the infrastructure to deliver the water to the nuclear plants, the coal plants, the fire plant, and the natural gas plants is just you know, they don't even talk about that. So solar energy is the cheapest form of energy, and it's also the safest. You know, I call solar safe nuclear because the sun is a nuclear reactor, mm-hmm. and the solar panels pick up the radiation at a safe distance and turn it directly into electricity. So all the way around, photovoltaics is the cheapest form of electricity, and any other form is just they're not including the externalities.
I completely agree, and externalities is a word you hear a lot on this program and probably not anywhere else, which is tragic. The latter part, you know, that nobody else is talking about it. Brilliant, Harvey. Very, very well said. Thanks a lot. David in Hammond, Indiana, listening to WCPT. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Mine is about pretty much about Wall Street and the big banks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, over the last couple of days, especially, you know, the Fed announced that they want to start slowly pulling out of the bond market and let the nation do on its own. And as soon as they do that, it's like pull out a gun, you pull out a gun, who's going to shoot first?
Yeah, it's more like the metaphor I prefer is, you know, two guys standing in a basement in up to their knees in gasoline, both of them holding a book of matches. I'm with you, David. But I would say it's not just, you know, it's not the bond market. It's the unregulated derivatives market. You have $600 to $900 trillion that are being traded right now, and money is being skimmed off the top in every single trade, hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars probably, being skimmed off the top in these trades that are showing up as profits on the balance sheets of banks, and these hundreds of trillions of dollars of derivatives. And keep in mind, the GDP of the entire planet Earth is $65 trillion a year. So how can you have $600 trillion worth of derivatives? Well, because they don't represent actual wealth. Their value is derived from some underlying thing. Well, that's nonsense. That's crazy. And yet it's making billions for banksters. And this is a market, this is a market that needs to be regulated. It needs to be closed. Derivatives. We should pass a law tomorrow that says the only people who can buy and sell any kind of transaction that has to do with commodities, whether it's the primary commodity itself or a derivative based on the commodity, are people who are going to either take delivery of the commodity or who are the suppliers of the commodity or who are in the business of transporting the commodity or who are insurance companies that insure the commodity at some stage along those three, you know, from manufacturer growing or whatever through delivery to the acceptance of delivery and the use of the commodity, period. In other words, the only counterparties who should be allowed in the commodities business are actual producers and users, producers and consumers. And if we were to do that, we would, and by the way, it used to be that way. It was that way from 1935 until around 1999, when Phil Gramm pushed through Congress and Bill Clinton signed the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, so that Enron could get into the banking business and the derivatives market. Phil Gramm's wife Wendy, of course, having been on the board of Enron, good buddies with Ken Lay. And that was 13 years ago, 14 years ago, and that cancer is still embedded in our banking system, and it needs to be extracted. Monica in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Monica, what's up?
Hey, first of all, I'd like to say, you know, yesterday or the day before, you were talking about security, and I was very surprised that you never mentioned cars having open mics in them, because ever since 2006 or something like that, they're built with...
The LoJack system.
OnStar. They've got black boxes on them. Even if you don't have OnStar, if you do have OnStar, that is an open mic.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you don't, you still have an open mic in your car plus a GPS on there. And I believe the government can shut down your car at will. But anyway, what I wanted to call you about was that I had heard the news, and I found out that our government is destroying $7 billion worth of military equipment. And
in the Middle East, as we withdraw from Iraq and Afghanistan, you mean?
As we're still at war with Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, no, we've officially pulled out of Iraq and stopped our participation there. There's still a few hundred soldiers there, you know, guarding the green zone and or our embassy, you know, our, quote, embassy. It's like a city within a city, but... by and large, no. And a lot of that equipment, they made the decision to destroy it in place because, A, they didn't want it to end up, you know, us arming a new government or rebels or whatever, and, B, it would have cost more to ship it back to the United States than its scrap value, and it basically was at the point where it was just scrap.
Even the Jeeps?
Yeah.
I mean, look at Cuba.
That's my understanding.
With those Jeeps.
Yeah. Pardon?
I said, look at Cuba. I'll bet you they could have done plenty with those Jeeps.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And my guess is that, you know, probably Iraq could have done plenty with those Jeeps, you know, in a way similar to Cuba. You know, you get entrepreneurs who would put them back into, and maybe they will, although I don't know to what extent we've destroyed them. Did we smash them into little tiny pieces, or did we simply take out any of the high tech parts that, you know, I don't know the details of it.
And here's another thing I found out, was that the budget for the military went up despite the sequester, and that was supposed to make it go down, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't supposed to make it go down. It was supposed to make it go up less. And, in fact, the sequester was not actually a cut to anybody's budget per se. It was a cut in the rate of rise of all these budgets. But keep in mind that given inflation, cutting the rate of increase is very often functionally a cut. So at least that's my understanding of how the sequester worked. That's certainly the way that the Republicans were selling it, and some Democrats were describing it that way. So, Monica, thank you for the call. Mike in Vail, Arizona. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just love your show.
Thank you.
And happy Friday, too.
Thank you.
You know, great show. You know, a lot of your callers today were talking about real issues that we all can connect with. And you know, so my question is, you know, with our laissez-faire banking system that has harmed so many, not only here in America, but across the globe, with our environmental policies, with our national security policies that have hurt us and hurt so many, at what point does the world start getting tired of waiting for America to clean up its own act and respond to really protect itself?
Well, the day before yesterday, you had the World Bank, the president of the World Bank, come out and say it's time to stop pretending there's no such thing as global climate change and get with the program. That if you're denying climate change, you're not actually denying climate change. You're denying the existence of science. That, you know, this is a settled issue now, for example. And I think he was speaking bluntly to the United States, because China just put into place this week in Shenzhen the very first carbon tax, cap and trade system on carbon dioxide. And they're, you know, if that works, they're going to take it countrywide. And Europe, since 2005 or 2006, has had a carbon tax, a cap and trade system carbon dioxide, and they've been steadily reducing their carbon dioxide emissions. We have some cities, we have some states that have taken this seriously and that have moved forward in reducing carbon dioxide emissions. They're all blue states, but they have, you know, several of them have been very, very successful at it and are bragging about it. But Yeah, laissez-faire economics, the hands-off economics, you know, get government out of the economics sphere, economics is helping to destroy the earth. And
it'd be interesting to find out what the rest of the world thought.
Oh, I can tell you what the rest of the world thinks. I'm hearing, yeah, Shane. Anyway, they think that we're seriously screwed up. They think that we're crazy, that we're brain dead, that the rest of the world is seriously worried about us. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And by the way, I can tell you that from personal experience, having traveled throughout the world. We are the weird step cousin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Or the crazy ant in the attic or whatever it is. You know, we are that for the world. And it's time for us to wake up and start behaving like good citizens. Welcome back. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News is with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up?
President Obama nominated James Comey to be head of the FBI today. He's a former Justice Department official who helped oversee national surveillance programs under President George W. Bush. He also praised Robert Mueller, the outgoing head of the FBI, who's held the director's post since the week before the September the 11th attacks, praising his humility, integrity, and calmness under pressure, saying most Americans probably wouldn't recognize him on the street, but all of us are better because of his service. Mm-hmm. Also saying of Comey that he is exceptionally qualified to handle the full range of challenges faced by today's FBI, from traditional threats like violence and organized crime to protecting civil rights and protecting children from exploitation.
Now, Comey is the guy who is like 6'8" or something. I mean, he's a giant. And he's also the guy, isn't he, who was in a high-speed car chase one night when the attorney general, what was the attorney general's name who covered the breasts of Lady
Liz? It was John Ashcroft.
John Ashcroft, thank you.
John Ashcroft was in a hospital bed, disoriented and extremely ill.
Right. He just had like gallbladder surgery or something. And Alberto Gonzalez ran over there to try and get him to sign an illegal order, and Comey would beat him to the bedside of John Ashcroft and sent Gonzalez on his way. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, it was Gonzalez and Andy Card. They were both in the room trying to get him to sign. It was a reauthorization of the warrantless wiretapping.
Right, and Comey said, "This is illegal. Can't do it."
Yes. Yeah.
So,
don't do it.
You know, that's a plus on his side. I understand he has overseen some wiretapping, shall we say.
Yes. And, of course, it's going to make for a very interesting confirmation hearing by the Senate, because he will be asked about that.
Yeah. I mean, he took on basically George W. Bush in that. You know,
yes,
Alberto Gonzalez didn't come up with that idea, out of his own, brilliance. So,
right. But he will, I think, be confirmed. He appeals to both sides. He's got a lot of integrity. He's seen as having a lot of integrity. And he did donate the maximum individual contribution, $5,000, to Mitt Romney last year.
Oh, very interesting. That's going to make it harder for the Republicans to say no.
He's no Chuck Hagel.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, what else is up?
Extraordinary story in The Guardian via Edward Snowden. Britain's GCHQ, which is their spy network, is tapping fiber optic cables for secret access to the world's communications. You think the NSA is collecting data? GCHQ is leaving the NSA in the dust.
Really?
It's collecting and storing vast quantities of global email messages, Facebook posts, internet histories and calls, and sharing them with the NSA.
Whoa. So has the NSA outsourced this stuff to the British intelligence, or are they?
No, they're doing it on their own. Thank you very much. They're a sovereign nation.
Well, let us not forget that George Orwell was British, and that 1984 takes place in the United Kingdom, does it not?
Yeah. This is unbelievably huge. Now, it's considered, some people say it's legal, some people say it's not legal. It is huge. And in fact, they boasted in 2010 that they had the biggest internet access of any member of what's known as, I didn't know this, the Five Eyes Electronic Eavesdropping Alliance, which comprises the U.S., the U.K., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand.
Remarkable. Now, have either Mr. Cameron or Mr. Clegg commented on this?
Well, they haven't commented so far, but they, of course, will have to comment because it's only just come out this afternoon. We are being told that it stopped plots.
Of course we've been told that.
They've been specific about plots in the UK. It has stopped.
Uh-huh.
There's some legitimacy of the operation in doubt. They've got around the law in a very obscure way. There's a law saying that the tapping of defined targets has to be authorized by a warrant signed by the Home Secretary.
Right, a variation on our Fourth Amendment.
Right, there's an obscure clause that allows the Foreign Secretary to sign a certificate for the interception of broad categories of material as long as one end of the monitored communications is abroad.
Hmm.
They're doing stuff that's completely in the UK. But the nature of modern fiber optic communications means that a proportion of internal UK traffic is relayed abroad and then returns through the cable.
Right. If somebody in the UK is using Gmail, maybe Google has servers in the UK now. They probably do. But they may well be routing that stuff through a giant server farm in Seattle or in Cupertino,
right,
or something.
So they've decided that counts as overseas, even though there's somebody in Luton talking to somebody in London.
Right. Or if they ping a website that's where the server is based in the U.S., then amazing.
But it's all for sharing with the Americans. They've had hundreds of thousands of Americans looking at this.
And hundreds of thousands?
Well, they say that there have been up to 850,000.
Oh, that's how many security clearances there are.
850,000 security clearances able to look at this stuff. And basically the guidance has been, well, we've got a very light footprint. You can basically look at what you like.
Wow. That's incredible.
It's pretty incredible. On to immigration. The Senate's moved forward with its bipartisan immigration measure with the tougher border security. It's going to hold votes early next week. And Monday it will vote on the Corker-Hooven Amendment with final approval Tuesday, which means they should be able to wrap everything up and get out of town by July the 4th, which, of course, is the big plan. That's what they really want.
Assuming that they actually get things done. Now, that's the Senate you're talking about?
That's the Senate, where they might actually get something done,
yeah.
Yes, unlike the House.
Yeah,
yes.
Unlike the House, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to continue this conversation. I'm sorry we're out of time, but I look forward to talking with you on Monday, Victoria.
Me too.
Okay, thank you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. You can read all of Victoria's reports. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program on Anything Goes Friday. We can talk about what's going on in Congress. We can talk about flying saucers. Flying saucers, really. Well, one of the few members of Congress who actually talked about flying saucers was Dennis Kucinich. I saw him a few days ago. Louise and I had dinner with him and Elizabeth, sat next to them at the correspondence dinner, the White House correspondence dinner, which was a radio TV dinner, which was very interesting. Good to see Dennis again, or Congressman, former Congressman Kucinich. He's one of those guys out there who will tell it how it is, generally speaking. Anyhow, Corrections Corporation, there is actually a news story that I wanted to share with you that I think this is a relatively big deal. And that is that the the private prison industry. Here it is. This is Arviva Shen posting it over on the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. The headline is, Three States Dump Major Private Prison Company in 1 month. And they talk about how Corrections Corporation of America, which is the largest and most powerful of all the private prison companies in the United States, quoting from the article, after extensive reports of abuse, neglect, and even fraud within their operation, lost four prison contracts in the past month. Idaho cut ties with the corporation on Wednesday, which had turned, this corporation had turned the state's largest prison into a violent hellhole inmates called Gladiator School. Earlier this year, still quoting from Aviva Shen's reporting, earlier this year, CCA was caught understaffing the prison and using prison gangs to control the population. The company admitted to falsifying nearly 4,800 hours of staffing records to squeeze more money out of the state for non-existent security work. Shift logs at the prison showed the same security guards working for 2 to 3 days at a time without breaks. Last week, Texas closed down two CCA prisons, including one with a history of suspicious prisoner deaths. One lawsuit alleges prison staff ignored an inmate's cries for medical assistance, forcing her to give birth in a prison toilet to a baby who died 4 days later. CCA was also booted out of Mississippi earlier this month. Boy, that takes a lot for Bobby Jindal to say, okay, enough already. After he's Louisiana, isn't he? Yeah. Who's the governor of Mississippi? That's old Haley Barber country, but I'm not sure who's the governor right now. Anyhow, CCA was also booted from Mississippi earlier this month after multiple deadly riots over poor food and sanitation, lack of medical care, mistreatment by guards. Mississippi's hiring another private prison company. Oh, no. To take over CCA's company. Yeah, you know, this privatization thing, it didn't work with this company, so we'll try it with another company. No, it just doesn't work. Every for-profit company is going to run your prison in a way that their CEO and their stockholders can skim money off the top. And instead of skimming money off the top, that state money that is going to the prisons should be used to rehabilitate people who are going to be sent back into the state population. We're not talking about dog kennels here, and even dog kennels or animal control pounds should be run by the state. They shouldn't be run by private corporations that are going to try and cut corners to make profits. The GEO Group, Mississippi, terminated a contract with another major private prison company, the GEO Group, after it was found guilty of turning a juvenile facility into, quote, a cesspool of unconstitutional and inhuman acts, end quote. This is incredible. Now, you know, this is an industry, so they're going to be out there buying politicians and buying public opinion and lobbying. And, you know, national security, military services, and police services are things that should never have been outsourced in the first place. This is like the evil side of Reaganomics. I mean, just plain evil, corrupting government. Anyhow, Matt in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Tom, it's an honor. I'm a former Ron Paul libertarian supporter, but after listening to you for a while and after being laid off for about a year and a half, it's easy to see how someone can change their views,
yeah.
But that's not what I called about.
Thank you.
I still have a moral problem with income tax, but... what I called about was the news just came across a little while ago that Jeffrey Skilling, ex-Enron executive, just got it reduced by 40%.
Mm-hmm.
By
paying some big bucks.
Okay.
My recollection is, Matt, that they were setting that thing up, that he was going to pay millions of dollars to the government in restitution or whatever, and they were then going to reduce his sentence, so... If you're rich enough, I guess, you know.
Exactly. Why not do both?
Yeah.
Serve the time and pay the money.
Yeah. Well, he has served a fair amount of time, but on the other hand, he destroyed a lot of people's lives. And probably, I would say almost certainly, led to some suicides and some homicides And you know, a lot of broken families and a lot of misery that's going to echo down through the generations, and
a lot of college funds depleted.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you name it.
A lot of retirement.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Go ahead.
The income tax.
Yeah.
Something I still struggle with on a moral level. What's the answer? Someone who's taxed 100% is a slave.
Right.
At what point can taxed no longer be a slave?
Well,
you know, is it 30%? I mean,
there's two pieces. There's two pieces to the
labor.
There's two pieces to the question, Matt. The first is, how are you going to finance the essential functions of government? And the second is, should we give preferential treatment in a tax system to people who are hanging on by their teeth, as opposed to somebody who was, you know, like Donald Trump, whose daddy gave him $400 million, you know, who was born rich, and then took that money and made more money with it, or the Walton heirs, or you know, Dagny Taggart, or whatever her name was, the heroine, Atlas Shrugged, the heroine. And so, number one, if you're going to figure out how you're going to pay for the functions of government, there are a couple of options. You can tax transactions, which we did in the United States for the first third of our history. It was pretty much all of government, all of federal government anyway, was funded by tariffs. We taxed trade transactions. And, you know, it worked, although our government was much, much smaller and our country was much smaller and much more agricultural and you know, people were more self-sufficient. People were actually richer, wealthier then, and because they had the ability to feed themselves. So number one, you can tax transactions. Number two, you can tax property, and we do tax property in most of our states. And I have a problem with the property tax, because I think that once you own property, you should say, this is my property, I own it. And property tax means you never own it. If you don't pay the tax, the property goes back to the state, so the state actually owns it. Three, you could tax wealth, which we do not do in the United States, but they do in many other countries, where if your wealth exceeds a certain amount, then every year you pay typically a 1%, 2%, or 3%, or a fraction of 1% tax on your total wealth. So if you have an estate that's worth more than $1 billion or $100 million, then you pay 1% of that every year. And four, you can tax income. And income is the most direct, it seems, way of measuring, you know, how a person's doing. So, you know, which would you pick, Matt?
I like the first one. You know,
tax and transactions
for 100 years.
But see, the problem is that people like Mitt Romney, who don't engage in very many transactions, then would pay very little taxes, and poor working people would pay all their. Hang on just a
second. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Because they spend every dollar they get, every dollar gets taxed. So that's really unfair to poor people. So, Matt, think about it. We'll carry this conversation on some other time. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. This is the one-armed man today. What's that, Sam? The Fugitive, yeah. Sam, what's his name? Actually, The Fugitive wasn't the one-armed man. It was the one-armed man who killed his wife, wasn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Or something like that. It's been a long time. A lot of years. Pat in Beloit, Wisconsin. Hey, Pat, what's on your mind? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Well, Tom, one thing I just learned from you is that money can't buy me love, but it can buy me justice.
Yeah. If you're Jeffrey Skilling.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember, because at your recommendation, I watched Client Number 9. Or is it Client 9 or whatever?
Yeah, Client Number 9. It's a brilliant movie about the fate of Elliot Spitzer.
Exactly. And it seems to me, it was hard to get a hold of, so I haven't been able to find it yet again. But it seems to me, wasn't a part of his being brought down the fact that they were able to check his emails and his bank records? And
illegally, yes.
Yes, and so to me, this is a perfect example of why the NSA can control a politician's life. I had heard about him when he was the do-all guy that took on the big corporations, and I thought I would vote for him someday.
Yeah, I thought I would vote for him for president someday.
Exactly.
I genuinely thought, and in fact, after watching Client Number 9, I was even more certain that Eliot Spitzer was one of the few politicians in the American landscape who had the potential to be the next Franklin Roosevelt.
Yes, or Kennedy, because he came from wealth but was taught service.
Yes, absolutely.
And basically, the only thing they caught him on was the Mann Act, from what I remember.
That's
but
correct.
I wanted to remind you of that movie because there is a perfect example of how it can be used unfairly against someone and bring them down.
Yeah. And really that exposes two things in our society. The fact that Eliot Spitzer, who was a brilliant, just a brilliant politician, a brilliant attorney general, a brilliant governor for the state of New York, and on his way to being, in my opinion, a brilliant president. There's just no doubt. I mean, and when you watch the movie, it's so obvious this guy would have made a brilliant. In fact, I still think Eliot Spitzer would make a brilliant president. But we have this thing in America about sex, and it's just it's bizarre. It's and he got nailed on this, and it's like the Puritanism of our country came out. Not that I'm all in favor of people being I'm not a proponent of infidelity, but that said, it doesn't seem to me that sleeping with a hooker is something. Maybe this is a male perspective. What do you think, Pat? It's something that should destroy a political
career. I look at Mr. Appalachian Trail and think there are many Republicans that have been forgiven. All you have to do is a mea culpa.
That's and right. David Vitter?
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And you can be forgiven. So I guess
David Vitter didn't even lose his seat. He didn't give up his seat, and he won re-election.
Exactly. So it's which party and how much you beg off that, you've redeemed yourself.
Yeah.
And that's a hypocritical situation to the extreme. I wish he would decide to run again for office because, yes, you're right, after seeing the movie, I felt even more strongly what a loss we have had to this country in his not becoming perhaps president.
Yeah. And Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton at least said, yes, I did it, and I'm going to stay here in the White House. I mean, but anyway, yeah. Excellent point, Pat. And for those of you who don't know what Pat and I are talking about, this movie, Client Number 9, is a really important movie to watch for a whole bunch of different reasons. In particular, in the context of the current NSA government spying scandal and in the context of our modern day feudalism, where basically the billionaires are running the world, because this is the story of Eliot Spitzer taking on and then angering a billionaire who decided to take him down and used illegal methods to do it. And and Spitzer, of course, had committed a crime. In the United States, it's a crime to hire a prostitute, and under the Mann Act, it's a crime to travel across state lines with one, which he did. And he arguably was a criminal, but that said, it's an amazing movie, a documentary. It's a documentary, Client Number 9. Pat, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to WCPT. Larry in Lancaster, California. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind? Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio.
Hey, Tom. On your Wednesday show, you were talking about Walmart's commercial they had out. And the commercial said over 60% of people shopped at Walmart. You consider that a monopoly?
Yeah.
Were you serious when you said that?
Yes.
And why do you think that's a monopoly?
Well, it's not literally a monopoly. It's, which would be one company. But it is close enough to a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act, in my opinion, that it shouldn't have been allowed to happen. When a Walmart moves in,
have a free choice to shop where they want to.
I beg your pardon?
Don't I have a free choice to shop where I want to?
Sure, you do. You do. And if you think that the way to have business function in the United States is without any regulation whatsoever, and therefore the largest company gets to destroy all the small companies anytime it wants by dropping prices, by using whatever anti-competitive methods that it wants, then you would be a fan of Walmart. When a Walmart comes into a community, typically 120 businesses go out of business. Local, family-owned businesses go out of business. And with
right.
those go lots and lots of jobs. And every night in every Walmart in the country, somebody pushes a button and a giant vacuum cleaner sucks all the money out of those communities and it ends up down in Bentonville, Arkansas, where a piece of it goes off to the five Walmart heirs who between those five people are worth more than one-third of the entire United States population. They're worth more than 100 million of us.
Walmart got started just like Lowe's did by one company that grew.
I agree. And had Reagan not stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, I don't think that Walmart would have become this the eggplant that ate Chicago, you know, this giant organization that's capable of inhaling communities. In India, up until very recently, they had a law that said that no corporation could own more than two stores. And that provided extraordinary business diversity.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Which, Larry, even though it's not really efficient, it's more inefficient, I think it's better for society. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday. Joe in Spring, Texas. Hey, Joe, you want to defend Walmart too?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Joe.
We've got a Walmart here in Spring. I'm actually in the Woodlands, which is above Spring, north of Spring.
Right.
We've got a Walmart, and the whole community's rocking. Business is great. I was just wondering if you could give me somehow, maybe email off air or something like that, a list of communities that Walmart has eaten, and I can check that out.
There have actually been books written about it, Joe. This is not rocket science. Walmart moves into communities. We are all subsidizing Walmart. Walmart is the largest private employer in the United States. And they are also, their employees are among the major consumers of food stamps and other welfare programs. So we are, you know, they pay so little that you and I are subsidizing their ability to pay their employees low wages, number one. Number two, Walmart moves into communities, and this is, well-documented history, and there's, like I said, there have been books written about this. To the best of my knowledge, nobody's actually debating this or has for decades. And they will drop prices. They run sales when they first move into communities, in many cases targeted against specific industries. Let's really push out the hardware stuff for a couple of months. And then the local hardware business, locally owned hardware stores go out of business. And now we own the hardware business. Let's push out the groceries. And then grocery stores go out of business. In a lot of communities these days, now that the dust has settled, I mean, a lot of this really destructive stuff happened back in the 80s and 90s and mostly in the 90s, I would say, because by the end of the 90s, Reagan's suspension of the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1982 really had taken hold. And so you had a lot of small businesses that had already been pushed out by other large national chains. So rather than having 5 or 8 or 10 or 12 locally owned, restaurants, instead what you had was, 5 or 6 chain restaurants. So you had an Applebee's and you had an Olive Garden and you had a McDonald's and you had, instead of, the local burger stand and the local Italian restaurant and the local whatever it may be. And restaurants is a bad example in the context of Walmart, but you get the point. We used to have locally owned hardware stores. We used to have locally owned stationery stores. We used to have locally owned grocery stores. And I'm guessing in Spring, Texas, you don't have much of that stuff anymore. I'm guessing that, although I've never been there, so you're the authority on Spring, Texas on this call. But I'm guessing that you have more of either Walmart or big national corporate chains, which are functionally the same thing as Walmart, keeping out small, locally owned entrepreneurial businesses.
Hmm.
Am I right?
I'll tell you, in Spring, Texas itself, it's a very old-timey town, and it's almost all locally owned businesses.
Well, that's great.
In the Woodlands, I'm looking. Yeah, we have an Ace Hardware. That's national.
Yeah.
And a Petco. But right next to them, we have a Red Mango, which I don't think is national.
Mm-hmm.
A Nothing Bundt Cakes. And a Witch is Witch.
I it's kind of mixed here, Tom.
Yeah. Well, you're fortunate. That's, you know, you live in a community that's like one of the last, you know, it's a fading breed. I used to live in Montpelier, Vermont. Louise and I lived in Montpelier for about 4 or 5 years, and which is the smallest state capital in the country, between 7,000 and 8,000 people. And we taxed ourselves. I remember going to one of the town meetings when we were living there in the early 2000s. And we taxed ourselves, the city of Montpelier taxed ourselves every year another $40,000 or $50,000. You know, it was distributed among the whole tax base, so it cost each one of us, you know, a dime or something, but or a half a dollar. But we taxed ourselves to pay for the lawyer to defend the lawsuit from McDonald's. McDonald's was really, really upset with Montpelier because Montpelier was the only state capital that there was no McDonald's in. And the way that Montpelier kept McDonald's out, and not just McDonald's, all the big chain restaurants, the way that they kept them out is they by zoning. They passed a zoning ordinance that said that you may only call yourself a restaurant or serve food if you do two things. You must A, have table service, and B, you must bake your bread on the premises if you serve breads. And so what we ended up with was there were only two chains that were that ever got a toehold in Montpelier. One was Dunkin' Donuts, and they actually started doing table service. And the other was a Subway franchise, and they did table service. Because Subway, you know, they make their own bread right there every morning. And Dunkin' Donuts, they make their donuts fresh every day. And Louise and I were in Montpelier a couple of months ago. I gave a keynote speech at Goddard College, and we drove by the old where the Dunkin' Donuts was, and they're out of business now. I don't know. They might have popped up someplace else in town, but the Subway is still there in town. But everything else is locally owned restaurants. That's it. There is no other chains. And, you know, that's how communities fight back. That's how communities say, we think that having locally owned businesses, keeping the money in our community rather than having the money go to Bentonville, Arkansas every night, or having the money go to New York City if it's, one of the big chains that's Wall Street owned, or having the money go to one of the big venture capital funds or something, whoever owns the various companies, is a good idea. It's actually not a good idea when you have locally owned businesses. A dollar spent in a locally owned business, you know, adds another 10 or 20 cents to the local community as it circulates through the community, whereas a dollar spent in a Walmart just goes out of the community, other than the small amount of money that goes to pay for local wages. But Walmart's wages are so low that the communities are supplementing those wages with welfare. So it's like, how can you say that this is a good thing for America?
Well, no, I don't say it's a good thing. I'm just saying here it's good. It's not good or bad. It's just it's happening.
Well, it's there. I mean, when Walmart moved into Barrie, Vermont, and it had happened before Louise and I moved there. Barrie's the next big town over from Montpelier. It's kind of the other side of the river, you know, sister city. The old industrial town in Montpelier was the old capital. And Walmart moved in, and it did put out of business a lot of local businesses. And that's, you know, any of the locals there will tell you the stories and name the businesses. But what I found interesting is while we were living there, I needed to buy some pillows. And I looked all over Vermont. You know, I want to buy them from a local company. And I could not find any place locally where I could buy pillows. So I went to Walmart. I mean, I had no choice, basically. And that's what you end up with, is you just basically don't have a choice. Everything else has been put out of business.
Right. Could you do me a favor? I don't want to monopolize the show, but is there any way to recommend the best book about Walmart? So I've never seen one.
I would, Amazon.com is like the Walmart of the internet, but if you go to Amazon.com and just type Walmart into the subject field, I'm guessing that you will see several. But it's been probably 5 years since we've done a show with one of the authors of one of these books on, so I don't have it at the top of my mind. But Joe, I'll try and get back to you on that next week, okay?
That is wonderful. Thanks for having me on, and I
sure
appreciate
enough.
It.
Thanks for the call. Diane in Lansing, Michigan, my hometown. Hey, Diane, what's up?
Yep. Hi, Tom. Actually, there's a good documentary on Walmart on Current TV. It's called The High Cost of Low Prices.
You're absolutely right
to know about it.
The High Cost of Low Prices, yes.
Yes. Well, my question is...
And that's
is,
Robert Greenwald. You can probably find that over at bravenewfilms.org.
Yes. Mm-hmm. My question is, what do you think of the Donnie Ferguson that did the food stamp challenge for 1 week?
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I would be more impressed if he had done it for a year.
Yeah, he's one of 30 congressmen who were doing
it.
30 members of Congress who were doing that. Peter DeFazio was doing the same thing out in Oregon. I what it does is it raises consciousness about, Donnie Ferguson is the guy who was the aide to the right-wing Republican who said that he was able to live on less than the $31.50 a week that food stamps gives you. He lived on $27 a week or something, and he said he made a $4 donation back to the government. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, but actually he was eating mostly junk food, and I don't see any fruits and vegetables in there.
Right. Yeah. Surprise, surprise. And this is one of the problems, too, is that, you know, junk foods are cheaper than actually eating good stuff. And so we have a poverty problem in America, and we have an obesity problem in America, and the obesity seems to be happening, you know, disproportionately among the poor population. And why is that? Because the foods that are the worst for you are the foods that are the cheapest. And
right.
And that's just, you know, we need to do something about that with regard to public policy. Mayor Bloomberg is talking about, you know, for example, let's say that you can't, what he has proposed is that you can no longer use food stamps in New York City to buy sugary sodas because there's, you know, just a huge body of evidence that they contribute substantially to obesity. So, Diane, thanks for the call. My take on it is, well, I guess we've hashed it out. Carmen in Hamilton, Montana. Hey, Carmen, what's up? Carmen, you are on the air. Carmen's not there. Okay. Alan in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. Got a minute to break.
Tom.
What's up?
Yeah, Tom, about a month ago I read in the New York Times that the CCA Corporation had changed their corporate status from a prison company to a real estate trust with the approval of the IRS
to a REIT.
So they could save millions in taxes.
Whoa!
But nobody ever said anything. I read it about a month ago and was very surprised.
I'm trying to think of how that would work for them. I suppose if they're fairly closely held.
They own property.
Yeah,
you know,
They
have prisons, and
right.
So they just turned it into a real estate company instead of a prison corporation.
Right. Very interesting. I can't speak to that, Alan. I don't know the details of it or anything about it. But assuming that what you said is true, it's just another example of if there is a loophole, there is a corporation that will find a way to use it, which is one of the reasons why we need to simplify our tax codes and. Which ain't going to happen until you get money out of politics.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Which ain't going to happen until we say corporations are not people and money is not speech, which is going to require us to amend the Constitution. Move to amend.org. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the folks at the various organizations and companies that syndicate this program, Dial Global on the commercial side, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial radio stations across the country, around the world, actually, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, CRN Cable Radio News, or Cable Radio Network, CRN, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, to all of the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and to the folks in our chat room, hey, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tampoli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. It means a lot. It keeps us going. It absolutely keeps us going. Lowell in Mount Lake Terrace. What state is that?
It's Washington.
Washington State. There you go. It had scrolled off. The city name was long enough that the state had scrolled off the little bar there on my screen. I couldn't see it. So what's up, Lowell?
Oh, I was just calling about the guy that thought he was free to shop wherever he wanted. I just wanted to ask him, why do you want to shop at the communist store? Because all your goods in that store are from communist China, communist Vietnam, Bangladesh. I mean... Hmm. And where can you buy American or where, you know...
Right, or the slave labor store.
American?
Yeah. And what's so ironic is when... I remember when Walmart was first growing in the 1980s, and Sam Walton was still alive. And a Walmart opened in just north of us. We were living in north suburban Atlanta, in Roswell, Georgia. And the banner was, you know, made in America. That was their slogan. That was Sam Walton's slogan. It was, you know, Walmart, made in America. Now, he took a lot of flack for forcing American manufacturers to make things cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. But then Sam died and everything changed. And so, yeah, your point.
Those in Congress that support or don't support the Buy America Act should be voted out of office immediately, and that would be all the Republicans.
Yeah, well, and a small number of Democrats also. I mean, let's face it, the free trade virus has infected both parties. Although it is universal in the Republican Party, it is more sporadic in the Democratic Party. But yeah, I'm with you, Lowell. Thanks a lot for the call. John in Minneapolis, listening on KTNF. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you? I'm the last conservative left in Minneapolis, but I've been listening to you for about 2.5 years, and I thought at first you were a sensible voice of dissent. But anyway, my question is to you is who among anybody more than Michael Bloomberg wants to command and control people's lives? First of all, he's worth $9 billion, give or take a few. And he literally bought the New York City election for $40 million of his own money.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
Okay.
I decried it on this program. Plan. His opponent spent $7 per vote, and he spent something like $100. It was some amazing amount of money. But that said, if you're the governor of a giant city or the governor of a state or the mayor of a large city, and a large chunk of your budget is health care, you're paying for health care because during the Reagan administration, Ronald Reagan suggested that if somebody shows up at an emergency room, we all should pay to have them treated, that nobody should be turned away if they're sick. Okay, so a large chunk of your budget is health care and the losses associated with people not being able to work because of illnesses that are preventable. You're looking at that and you say, you know, there's a way that I can reduce these illnesses that are associated with, in this case, obesity. And the way that I can do that is by making it more difficult for people to consume large quantities of sugary drinks. That seems to me like a rational equation. Now, if the city of New York was not paying any health expenses and had no, you know, if there was no good public reason for all the taxpayers of New York to be concerned about the health of New Yorkers, I think you'd be right. But the fact of the matter is that New York City is a community. It's a city. And it is, you know, caring for everybody at a certain level, you know, particularly people who fall through the cracks. But everybody, you know, there is a cost to the city to obesity. And what they're saying is we're going to reduce that cost. Now, what's wrong with that?
For people on welfare,
if you're on food stamps, and because the population on food stamps is disproportionately obese. And so he's saying if you're on food stamps, you can't buy sugary sodas with them.
Fair enough on that. On that, for somebody who's, on food stamps like that, I agree. But he wants to ban trans fat for you and I.
Yeah. That's fine with me. If I'm eating in a restaurant in New York City, I would love to know that there's not any cancer-causing trans fats in my food. What's wrong with that?
When is the owner ever in the bar? He's barring it? It's still a free country, is it not? If a restaurant wants to serve something with trans fat in it, shouldn't, and you don't, you can choose not to eat there, can you, or can you not?
Well, yeah, we could, and I suppose that he could have said, you know, we're just going to require labeling, transparency.
Absolutely.
Trans fat is something that there is no reason to have except to make money. Right? These are fats. You can have healthy fats or you can have trans fats. And the trans fats are just, you know, they're fats that have been supersaturated with hydrogen and other processes that are, you know, they cause heart disease. I said cancer earlier. They cause heart disease. They clog arteries. They cause arteriosclerosis. They cause strokes and things. And the only reason they're in the food supply is so that somebody can make a little extra profit, period. Now, if they had any nutritional value, if they even tasted better, I might agree with you, John. But I can't think of any reason why any rational person would want to say, I want some trans fats. It's like saying, hey, I want me some arsenic. That sounds like fun. Coming up Monday, we'll have a conversation with economist Dr. Richard Wolff, author of Democracy at Work, about China's economy and what's going on in Turkey and Brazil. Plus, Trayvon Martin's accused killers on trial with an all-female, mostly white jury. What's that about? Get an update with Debbie Hines of Legal Speaks and the best of the rest of the news and your calls and whatever else has happened. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It starts with you. Get out there, get active, tag your in. Occupy something. Hey, have a great weekend. See you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.